Then, one day, a third grade teacher had an idea. Since he had to spend so much time transcribing test scores, he decided to also note on each student's index cards which specific questions they had gotten wrong on that week's assessment exam. He convinced another third grade teacher to do the same. Next, they combined their cards and made piles by grouping students who had made similar mistakes. When they were done, the piles showed a pattern. A large number of students in one class had done well on pronoun use, but had stumbled at fractions. A large number of students in the other classroom had scored the opposite way. The teachers traded curricula. Both classes' scores went up. The following week, someone else suggested dividing cards from multiple classes into piles based on where students lived. Teachers started giving everyone from the same neighborhood similar reading assignments. Test scores ticked up. Students were doing their homework together on the bus rides home. Johnson began putting her students into work groups based on the piles of cards she was making in the data room. Handling the index cards, she found, gave her a more granular sense of each student's strengths and weaknesses. She found herself going into the data room a couple of times a week and putting students' cards into smaller and smaller piles, experimenting with arranging them in different ways. She had felt before like she knew her class pretty well, but this was a far deeper level of understanding. When there are 25 students and just one teacher, it's easy to stop seeing them as individuals, she said. I had always thought of them as a class. The data room made me focus on particular kids. It forced me to look at them one by one and ask myself, what does this kid need? Midway through the year, some of Johnson's colleagues noticed that a small group of students in each class were struggling on math questions. It wasn't a big enough trend that any one teacher would have noticed on their own, but inside the data room, the pattern became clear. That's how the school-wide hot pencil drills started. Soon, students such as 8-year-old Dante were spending each morning filling out multiplication tables as fast as they could, and then speed-walking to the main office to have the fastest test takers' names read over the PA system. Within 12 weeks, the school's math scores were up by 9%. 8 months after the elementary initiative was launched, Johnson's class sat for their yearly assessment exam. By that point, she was visiting the data room all the time. She and her colleagues had created dozens of piles of index cards. They had tested various lesson plans and were tracking results on long strips of paper torn from rolls and taped to the walls. Columns of numbers and scribbled notes filled the data room. The test results came back 6 weeks later. Johnson's students scored an average of 72%, almost double her class's result the previous year. The school's overall scores had more than doubled. In 2009, Johnson became a teacher coach, traveling to other schools in Cincinnati to help instructors learn to use their own data rooms. In 2010, she was selected by her peers as Cincinnati's Educator of the Year. 4. Delia Morris was a high school freshman when Cincinnati launched the Elementary Initiative, and so she was too old to benefit from the reforms occurring at places such as South Avondale. And by the time city officials began expanding the program, it seemed too late for her in other respects. Delia's father was fired that year from his job as a security guard at a local grocery store. Then he got into a fight with their landlord. Not long after, Delia came home to find an orange sticker and a padlock on the apartment's front door, and everything she and her 7 siblings owned stuffed into black garbage bags in the hall. The family was able to stay with people from their church for a while, and then crowded into the apartments of family friends, but from that point on, they moved every few months. Delia was a good kid and a hard worker. Her teachers had noticed she was unusually smart, gifted enough, they felt, to make it out of Cincinnati's bad neighborhoods and into college. But that didn't mean escape was guaranteed. Every year, there were a handful of students who seemed destined for something better until poverty pulled them back down. Delia's teachers were hopeful, but not naive. They knew that even for gifted students, a better life was sometimes out of reach. Delia knew that as well. She worried that even a whiff of homelessness would change how her teachers perceived her, so she didn't tell anyone what was going on at home. "Going to school was the best part of each day," she told me. "I didn't want to ruin that." When Delia started her sophomore year at Western Hills High in 2009, the city began expanding its education reforms to high schools. However, some early results among older students proved disappointing. Teachers complained that innovations such as the data rooms were a start, but not a solution. Older students were already too hardened, their teachers said. Their timelines for intervention were too short. To change kids' lives, they argued, schools needed to help students get better at making the kinds of decisions that offered few opportunities for experimentation. They needed to help teenagers decide between going to college or getting a job, whether to terminate a pregnancy or get married. How to pick among family members when everyone needs your help. So the school district shifted its focus for high school students. Alongside the elementary initiative, the district began creating engineering classes within Western Hills High and other schools in partnership with local universities and the National Science Foundation. The goal was a multidisciplinary approach to education that encourages students to leverage the technology they use in their daily lives to solve real-world problems, a summary of the program read. 90% of students at Western Hills lived below the poverty line. Their classrooms had peeling linoleum floors and cracked chalkboards. Leveraging technology was not what most students worried about. Delia signed up for an engineering course taught by Dion Edwards, whose introductory remarks reflected the reality that surrounded all of them. "We're going to learn how to think like scientists," he told his class. "We're going to leave your parents and friends behind and learn to make choices with clear eyes, without the baggage everyone wants to put on you. And if any of you didn't have anything to eat this morning, I keep energy bars in my desk, and you should help yourself. There's nothing wrong with saying you're hungry." The real focus of Mr. Edwards' class was a system for decision-making known as the engineering design process, which forced students to define their dilemmas, collect data, brainstorm solutions, debate alternative approaches, and conduct iterative experiments. The engineering design process is a series of steps that engineers follow when they are trying to solve a problem and design a solution for something. "It is a methodical approach to problem solving," one teacher's manual explained. The engineering design process was built around the idea that many problems that seem overwhelming at first can be broken into smaller pieces, and then solutions tested again and again until an insight emerges. The process asked students to define precisely the dilemma they wanted to solve, then to conduct research and come up with multiple solutions, and then conduct tests, measure results, and repeat the procedure until an answer was found. It told them to make problems more manageable until they fit into scaffolds and mental folders that were easier to carry around. The class's first big assignment was to design an electric car. For weeks, students in Mr. Edwards' class arranged themselves into teams and followed flowcharts detailing each engineering design process step. The classroom had few materials to work with. But that was okay, because the real point of the exercise was to learn how to squeeze information from your environment, no matter where it comes from. Soon, students were visiting car dealerships, going to mechanic shops, and raiding aluminum cans from recycling bins to make battery testing kits from instructions they had found online. My first job is to teach them to slow down a little bit, Dion Edwards told me. These are kids who solve problems all day long. They deal with missing parents and violent boyfriends and classmates on drugs. Everything they experience says they have to choose quickly. I just want to show them that if you have a system for making choices, you can afford to slow down and think. Midway through the semester, after the class had completed their car designs and moved on to building marble sorters, Delia's 21-year-old sister had a baby. The child's father was out of the picture, and Delia's sister, exhausted, begged her to babysit in the afternoons. It felt like a request that was impossible for Delia to refuse. The right decision, Delia's dad told her, was obvious. This was family. So one day in Mr. Edwards' class, Delia pulled the engineering flowchart from her binder and, with her group, put her dilemma through the design process's steps. If she babysat, what would happen? One of the first tasks in engineering design is finding data, so Delia began making a list of experiences that seemed germane. Another sister, Delia told the group, had taken an after-school job a few years earlier, and the family had quickly come to rely on that paycheck, making it impossible for her to quit and putting her hopes of community college on hold. If Delia started babysitting, something similar would happen, she suspected. That was data point one. Then Delia began writing out what her schedule might look like if she was responsible for an infant every afternoon. School from 8:30 to 3:30. Babysitting from 3:30 to 7:30. Homework from 7:30 to 10 o'clock. She would be tired after watching her nephew and would probably end up watching television instead of doing her math or studying for a test. She would become resentful and make bad choices on the weekends. Data point two. As her group walked through the flowchart, they broke her dilemma into smaller pieces and brainstormed solutions and role-played conversations while the rest of the class discussed how to separate colored marbles from clear ones. Eventually, an answer emerged. Babysitting seemed like a minor sacrifice, but the evidence suggested it wasn't minor at all. Delia prepared a memo for her father listing the steps she had gone through. She wouldn't be able to do it, she told her dad. Psychologists say learning how to make decisions this way is important, particularly for young people, because it makes it easier for them to learn from their experiences and to see choices from different perspectives. This is a form of disfluency that allows us to evaluate our own lives more objectively, to offset the emotions and biases that might otherwise blind us to the lessons embedded in our pasts. When the animators behind Frozen were trying to figure out their film, the Disney system pushed them to look to their own lives as creative fodder. But it's not just creative material we can mine from our experiences. We can find data in our pasts as well. We all have a natural tendency to ignore the information contained in our previous decisions, to forget that we've already conducted thousands of experiments each time we make a choice. We're often too close to our own experiences to see how to break that data into smaller bits. But systems such as the engineering design process, which forces us to search for information and brainstorm potential solutions, to look for different kinds of insights and test various ideas, help us achieve disfluency by putting the past in a new frame of reference. It subverts our brain's craving for binary choices, should I help my sister or let my family down, by learning to reframe decisions in new ways. One important study of the power of such decision-making frames was published in 1984 after a researcher from Northwestern University asked a group of participants to list reasons why they should buy a VCR based on their own experiences. Volunteers generated dozens of justifications for such a purchase. Some said they felt a VCR would provide entertainment. Others saw it as an investment in their education or a way for their families to spend time together. Then, those same volunteers were asked to generate reasons not to buy a VCR. They struggled to come up with arguments against the expenditure. The vast majority said they were likely to buy one sometime soon. Next, the researcher asked a new group of volunteers to come up with a list of reasons against purchasing a VCR. "No problem," they replied. Some said watching television distracted them from their families. Others said that movies were mindless and they didn't need the temptation. When those same people were then asked to list reasons for buying a VCR, they had trouble coming up with convincing reasons to make the purchase and said they were unlikely to ever buy one. What interested the researcher was how much each group struggled to adopt an opposing viewpoint once they had an initial frame for making a decision. The two groups were demographically similar. They should have been equally interested in buying a VCR. At the very least, they should have generated equal numbers of reasons to buy or spurn the machines. But once a participant grabbed onto a decision-making frame, "This is an investment in my education," versus "This is a distraction for my family," they found it hard to envision the choice in a different way. A VCR was either a tool for learning or a time-wasting distraction, based on how the question was framed. Similar results have been found in dozens of other experiments in which people were presented with decisions ranging from the vital, such as end-of-life choices, to the costly, such as buying a car. Once a frame is established, that context is hard to dislodge. Frames can be uprooted, however, if we force ourselves to seek fresh vantage points. When Delia put her babysitting dilemma through Mr. Edwards's flowcharts, it introduced just enough disfluency to disrupt the frame she had initially assumed she should use. When she went home and walked her father through her logic, it shifted his frame as well. She couldn't care for her nephew, she told him, because Mr. Edwards's robotics club required her to stay at school until 6 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that club was her path to college. What's more, the other days of the week she needed to get her homework done in the library before coming home, because otherwise it wouldn't get finished amid the family's chaos and noise. She reframed the decision as a choice between helping her family now or succeeding at school and helping in other, more important ways down the road. Her father agreed. They would find another babysitter. Delia needed to stay in school. Our brain wants to find a simple frame and stick with it, the same way it wants to make a binary decision, Eric Johnson, the Columbia psychologist, told me. That's why teenagers get stuck thinking about breaking up with a boyfriend as, "Do I love him or not?" rather than, "Do I want to be in a relationship, or do I want to be able to leave for college?" Or why, when you're buying a car, you start thinking, "Do I want the power windows or the GPS?" rather than, "Am I sure I can afford this car?" But when we teach people a process for reframing choices, when we give them a series of steps that causes a decision to seem a little bit different than before, said Johnson, it helps them take more control of what's going on inside their heads. One of the best ways to help people cast experiences in a new light is to provide a formal decision-making system, such as a flowchart, a prescribed series of questions, or the engineering design process, that denies our brains the easy options we crave. Systems teach us how to force ourselves to make questions look unfamiliar, said Johnson. It's a way to see alternatives. As Delia moved into her senior year at Western Hills High, her home life became increasingly chaotic. Her sister was there, raising the baby. Another sister had dropped out of school. The family would find a place to live, and then something would happen. Another lost job, or a neighbor who complained about too many people in a one-bedroom apartment, and they would have to move again. In her senior year, Delia's family finally found a long-term rental, but it didn't have heat, and sometimes, when there wasn't money to pay the bill, the electricity went off. Her teachers, by then, had figured out what was going on and had seen how hard Delia was working. She was getting straight A's. They committed themselves to helping her however they could. When Delia needed to do laundry, her English teacher, Ms. Thole, would invite her over for the afternoon. When Delia seemed exhausted, Mr. Edwards would let her stay late in his classroom and nap, her head on the desk, as he graded exams. They saw her potential. They hoped, with a little help, she could make it to college. Mr. Edwards, in particular, was a constant in Delia's life. He introduced her to the school's guidance counselor and helped her apply for scholarships. He edited her college applications and made sure they were sent in on time. When Delia had a problem with her friends, when she was fighting with a boyfriend or sparring with her dad, when it seemed like she had too much homework and too little time, whenever it seemed like life was overwhelming, she pulled out Mr. Edwards's flowchart and put her troubles through the engineering design process. It was calming. It helped her think of solutions. In the spring of Delia's senior year, letters began arriving from scholarship committees. She won the $10,000 Nordstrom Scholarship, then a Rotary Prize, then the University of Cincinnati's Minority Scholars Grant. The envelopes kept coming. 17 scholarships in all. She was the class valedictorian and was voted most likely to succeed. The night before graduation, she slept at Ms. Thole's house so she could take a hot shower and curl her hair before the ceremony. In the fall, she enrolled at the University of Cincinnati. "College is a lot harder than I expected," Delia told me. She's a sophomore now, majoring in information technology. She's often the only girl in her classes and the only black student. The university has tried to help students like Delia, first-generation college attendees, by creating a program named Gen 1 that provides mentors, tutors, mandatory study sessions, and guidance counseling. Gen 1 participants all live in the same dorm freshman year and sign a 7-page contract in which they promise to abide by a curfew, respect evening quiet hours, and participate in study halls. The idea is to help them get some distance from where they grew up, to see themselves in a new context. "There's still drama at home," Delia said. But when things feel overwhelming, Delia thinks about Mr. Edwards' class. "Any problem can be worked through, step by step. If I take something that's bothering me and make it into smaller pieces, it feels like something I can think about without getting upset," she said. "I've been through a lot, but I feel like, as long as I've got a system for getting outside my head, I can learn from it. Anything that's happened to me can be a lesson, if I think about it right." The people who are most successful at learning, those who are able to digest the data surrounding them, who absorb insights embedded in their experiences and take advantage of information flowing past, are the ones who know how to use disfluency to their advantage. They transform what life throws at them, rather than just taking it as it comes. They know the best lessons are those that force us to do something and to manipulate information. They take data and transform it into experiments whenever they can. Whether we use the engineering design process, or test an idea at work, or simply talk through a concept with a friend, by making information more disfluent, we paradoxically make it easier to understand. In one study published in 2014, researchers from Princeton and UCLA examined the relationship between learning and disfluency by looking at the difference between students who took notes by hand while watching a lecture and those who used laptops. Recording a speaker's comments via longhand is both harder and less efficient than typing on a keyboard. Fingers cramp. Writing is slower than typing, and so you can't record as many words. Students who use laptops, in contrast, spend less time actively working during a lecture, and yet they still collect about twice as many notes as their handwriting peers. Put differently, writing is more disfluent than typing because it requires more labor and captures fewer verbatim phrases. When the researchers looked at the test scores of those two groups, however, they found that the handwriters scored twice as well as the typists in remembering what a lecturer said. The scientists at first were skeptical. Maybe the handwriters were spending more time studying after class. They conducted a second experiment, but this time they put the laptop users and the handwriters in the same lecture and then took away their notes as soon as it was over, so students couldn't study on their own. A week later, they brought everyone back. Once again, those who took notes by hand scored better on a test of the lecture's content. No matter what constraints were placed on the groups, the students who forced themselves to use a more cumbersome note-taking method, who forced disfluency into how they processed information, learned more. In our own lives, the same lesson applies. When we encounter new information and want to learn from it, we should force ourselves to do something with the data. It's not enough for your bathroom scale to send daily updates to an app on your phone. If you want to lose weight, force yourself to plot those measurements on graph paper, and you'll be more likely to choose a salad over a hamburger at lunch. If you read a book filled with new ideas, force yourself to put it down and explain the concepts to someone sitting next to you, and you'll be more likely to apply them in your life. When you find a new piece of information, force yourself to engage with it, to use it in an experiment, or describe it to a friend. And then you will start building the mental folders that are at the core of learning. Every choice we make in life is an experiment. Every day offers fresh opportunities to find better decision-making frames. We live in a time when data is more plentiful, cheaper to analyze, and easier to translate into action than ever before. Smartphones, websites, digital databases, and apps put information at our fingertips. But it only becomes useful if we know how to make sense of it. In 2013, Dante Williams graduated from the fifth grade at South Avondale Elementary. On his last day of school, he went to a party at the same playground where the teenager had been murdered at the Peace Bowl 6 years before. There were balloons and a bouncy castle, a cotton candy machine, and a DJ. South Avondale was still located inside one of Cincinnati's poorest areas. There were still drugs and boarded-up homes near the campus. But 86% of the school's students exceeded the state's education standards that year. The previous year, 91% of students had tested above the state standards. There was a list of kids from outside the district waiting to transfer in. No school changes because of just one program, of course, just as no student succeeds because of one class or one teacher. Both Dante and Delia, as well as South Avondale and Western Hills High, changed because multiple forces came together at once. There were dedicated teachers and a renewed sense of purpose among administrators. There were focused principals and parents supporting the reforms. But dedication and purpose only succeed when we know how to direct them. The data rooms that turned information into real knowledge. The teachers who learned how to see their students as individuals with different needs and strengths. That's how Cincinnati's public schools shifted. At the graduation ceremony, as Dante walked across the makeshift stage, his family cheered. Like all diplomas handed out that day, his contained a blank space, There was one last thing, the principal told him. No one was allowed to finish elementary school without doing a final bit of work. Dante had to transform this diploma and make it his own. She handed Dante a pen. He filled in the space with his name. Appendix: A Reader's Guide to Using These Ideas. A few months after I reached out to Atul Gawande, the author and physician from the introduction who helped spark my interest in the science of productivity, I began reporting this book. For almost 2 years, I conducted interviews with experts, read piles of scientific papers, and tracked down case studies. At some point, I began to imagine that I had become something of a productivity expert myself. When it came time to start writing, I figured translating all those ideas onto paper would be relatively easy. The words would fly from my fingertips. That is not what happened. Some days I would sit at my desk and spend hours jumping from website to website, looking for new studies to read, then organize my notes. I would get onto airplanes, my carry-on bag stuffed with scientific papers I intended to read, and spend the flight returning emails, writing to-do lists, and ignoring the big, important tasks I needed to complete. I had a goal in mind. I wanted to write a book about how we can apply these discoveries in productivity to our own lives. But it seemed so far off, so overwhelming, that I kept focusing on easier-to-accomplish objectives. A few months went by, and all I had to show for it was a series of outlines, but no chapters. "I feel like a failure," I wrote my editor during one particularly dispiriting moment. "I don't know what I'm doing wrong." When he wrote back, he pointed out the obvious. Maybe I needed to take what I was learning from the experts and apply it to my own life. I had to live by the principles described in this book. Motivation. One of my hardest challenges, for instance, concerned my motivation, which seemed to flag at exactly the wrong times. While I was working on this book, I was still also a reporter at the New York Times. What's more, I was out promoting my previous book and trying to be a good father and husband. In other words, I was exhausted. After a long day at the Times, I would come home and need to start typing up notes, or draft a chapter, or help put my kids to bed, or clean up the dishes, or reply to emails. And I'd find that self-motivation was in short supply. Emails, in particular, were a small form of daily torture. My inbox was constantly stuffed with questions from colleagues, queries from other authors, correspondence from researchers whom I hoped to interview, and other miscellaneous questions that required a thoughtful response. However, all I wanted to do was watch TV. As I struggled each night to find the drive to reply to emails, I began thinking about the key insight from Chapter 1 and the ideas that General Charles Krulak used to redesign Marine Corps boot camp by strengthening recruits' internal locus of control. Motivation becomes easier when we transform a chore into a choice. Doing so gives us a sense of control. On any given day, for instance, I had, let's say, at least about 50 emails that needed responses. Every evening, I would resolve to sit down at my computer and deal with them as soon as dinner was over. And every evening, I would find ways to procrastinate by reading the kids one more story, or cleaning up the living room, or checking Facebook, in order to avoid the drudgery of typing response after response. Or I would sweep through my inbox, hitting the reply key again and again, and then, confronted with a screen full of responses awaiting my words, feel overwhelmed. General Krulak had told me something that stuck with me. Most recruits don't know how to force themselves to start something hard. But if we can train them to take the first step by doing something that makes them feel in charge, it's easier to keep going. I realized that Krulak's insight could help me motivate. And so one night, after putting the kids to bed, I sat at my laptop and hit the reply button, creating a series of responses. Then, as fast as I could, I typed a sentence within each email, any sentence at all, to get me going. For instance, a coworker sent a note asking if I could join him at a meeting. I had put off replying because I didn't want to attend. I knew the meeting would be long and boring, but I couldn't completely ignore him. So I wrote one sentence in my response. I can't attend, but I'll need to leave after 20 minutes. I went through 24 replies just like that, writing a short sentence in each one, hardly thinking about it. And then I went back and filled in the rest of each email. Hey, Jim. Sure, I can attend, but I'll need to leave after 20 minutes. I hope that's okay. Thanks, Charles. I noticed two things. First, it was much easier to reply to an email once I had at least one sentence on the screen. Second, and more important, it was easier to get motivated when that first sentence was something that made me feel in control. When I told Jim that I could only stay for 20 minutes, it reminded me that I didn't have to commit to his project if I didn't want to. When I drafted a reply to someone asking me to come to speak at a conference, I began by typing, "I would like to leave on Tuesday and be back in New York by Thursday night," which reinforced that I was in control of whether I attended or not. Put differently, as I typed a series of short replies, each reminded me that I was in control of the choices being put before me. As a psychologist might say, I used those sentences to amplify my internal locus of control. Within 35 minutes, I had cleared out my inbox. But what about other kinds of procrastination? What about when you're confronting a bigger, more involved task, like writing a long memo or having a hard conversation with a colleague? What if there isn't an easy way to prove to yourself that you're in control? For those, I remember the other key lesson from the motivation chapter. Self-motivation becomes easier when we see our choices as affirmations of our deeper values and goals. That's why Marine Corps recruits ask each other why. Why are you climbing this mountain? Why are you missing the birth of your daughter? Why are you cleaning a mess hall, or doing push-ups, or running onto a battlefield when there are safer, easier ways to live? Forcing ourselves to explain why we are doing something helps us remember that this chore is a step along a longer path, and that by choosing to take that journey, we are getting closer to more meaningful objectives. To motivate myself to read studies on airplanes, for instance, I began writing at the top of each manuscript why it was important for me to get that task done. When I pulled a study out of my bag then, it became a little easier to dive in. Something as simple as jotting down a couple of reasons why I am doing something makes it much simpler to start. Why read this paper? It will help me find the right character for chapter 1. It will help me finish the book. It will help me solve how productivity works. Motivation is triggered by making choices that demonstrate to ourselves that we are in control, and that we are moving toward goals that are meaningful. It's that feeling of self-determination that gets us going. To generate motivation, make a choice that puts you in control. If you're replying to emails, write an initial sentence that expresses an opinion or decision. If you need to have a hard conversation, decide where it will occur ahead of time. The specific choice itself matters less in sparking motivation than the assertion of control. Figure out how this task is connected to something you care about. Explain to yourself why this chore will help you get closer to a meaningful goal. Explain why this matters, and then you'll find it easier to start. Goal setting. Simply figuring out how to motivate myself wasn't always enough, however. Writing a book is a big goal, too big in many ways to grasp the entirety of it at first. In trying to figure out how to wrap my head around the objective, I was helped enormously by the reporting I conducted regarding goal setting. The big takeaway was that I needed two kinds of aims. I needed a stretch goal, something to spark big ambitions. And I needed a SMART goal to help me form a concrete plan. One of the most effective ways to formulate both objectives, experts told me, is through a specific kind of to-do list. I needed to write out my goals, but in a way that forced me to identify my stretch objectives and my SMART aims. So I began writing to-do lists, and at the top of each one, I wrote my overarching ambition, what I was working toward in the long term. That helped me avoid the need for cognitive closure that can force us to become obsessed with short-term, easy-to-achieve goals. And then underneath, I described a sub-goal and all its SMART components, which forced me to come up with a plan, which, in turn, made it more likely that all my goals would be achieved. One of my stretch goals in reporting this book, for instance, was to find a story that illustrated how mental models worked. I knew that aviation experts felt that mental models played an important role in how pilots responded to emergencies, and so, at the top of my to-do list for this chapter, I wrote, Chapter 3 To-Do, Stretch, Find Aviation Story, Narrowly Averted Crash, that demonstrates mental models. Then, below that stretch goal, I wrote my SMART goals related to that big ambition. Specific. Locate an aviation expert by researching academic papers on Google Scholar. Measurable. Call 4 experts each morning until I find the right person story. Achievable. Clear my morning schedule to focus on this task and turn off email from 9 o'clock to 11:30. Realistic. On Monday, spend an hour researching aviation experts and creating a call list. Rank those experts and, by 10:15, begin my 4 calls of the day. At the end of each conversation, ask them to recommend other experts to call. Timeline. If I do 4 calls a day, then I should have made at least 16 calls by Thursday. If I haven't found the perfect story by Thursday, I'll come up with a new plan. If I do find the right story, I'll send a synopsis to my editor on Friday. It took only a few minutes to jot down these stretch and SMART goals, but it made a huge difference in how much I got done that week. Now I create a similar to-do list for every big task, and as a result, I know exactly what to do when I sit at my desk each morning. Instead of having to make decisions and running the risks of distraction, I have a clear sense of how to proceed. In addition, because I'm always being reminded of my stretch goal, I don't get easily sidetracked or captured by the need to simply check things off of my list. As scientists might say, I've muted my craving for cognitive closure. I don't stop working merely because I had a good interview, or because I found a helpful study, or because I found an interesting narrative that might go in the book. Instead, I'm always reminded that I'm chasing SMART goals for a bigger reason: to find the perfect story, or finish a chapter, or write a book. In fact, I have a whole series of stretch goals to remind me of my grander ambitions. Chapter 3. Stretch. Explain mental models. Stretch. Open with Air France 447. Explain why it crashed. Stretch. Explain cognitive tunneling. Stretch. Find a plane crash that was averted. Stretch. Find a study that explains mental models in everyday workplace. To set goals, choose a stretch goal, an ambition that reflects your biggest aspirations. Then, break that into sub-goals and develop SMART objectives. Focus. This being real life, however, there are always distractions and other demands competing for my attention. And so, in addition to having a plan, I needed to work on maintaining my focus. There's a key insight from the chapter about the averted aviation disaster of Qantas Flight 32 that I have tried to keep in mind. We aid our focus by building mental models, telling ourselves stories about what we expect to see. To make sure I stayed focused on my stretch and SMART goals, I had to envision what I expected to happen when I sat down at my desk each morning. And so, every Sunday night, I got into a habit of taking a few moments with a pad and pen to imagine what the next day and week ought to look like. I usually chose three or four things I wanted to make sure happened and made myself answer a series of questions. My goal: find an aviation story that illustrates mental models. What will happen first? I'll compile a list of aviation experts. What distractions are likely to occur? There will be a ton of emails waiting. How will you handle that distraction? I won't check my email account until 11:30. How will you know you've succeeded? I'll have made at least 10 calls and spoken to 4 aviation experts. What is necessary for success? I'll need a cup of coffee so I'm not tempted to get up. What will you do next? I'll research leads and prepare a call list for the next day. It typically takes only a few minutes to envision what I hope will occur. But by the end of this exercise, I have a story in my mind, a mental model of how my morning should proceed. And as a result, when distractions inevitably arise, it's easier to decide, in the moment, whether they deserve my focus or can be ignored. If my email account says there are 30 new messages, I know that I should ignore them until 11:30, because that's what the story inside my head tells me to do. If the phone rings and caller ID indicates it's an expert I'm trying to contact, I'll take the call, because that interruption has a place within my mental model. I have a stretch goal and a SMART goal that give me a plan, and a picture inside my head of how that plan is supposed to unfold, so making the choices that shape focus is much easier. To stay focused, envision what will happen. What will occur first? What are potential obstacles? How will you preempt them? Telling yourself a story about what you expect to occur makes it easier to decide where your focus should go when your plan encounters real life. Decision-making. I had worked on coming up with stretch goals and SMART objectives. I had a mental model to stay focused. I had found ways to improve my motivation. Despite all that, however, every so often something came along that would blow my well-crafted intentions apart. Sometimes it was small, like my wife asking if I wanted to get lunch together. Sometimes it was big, like an editor asking me to take on an exciting but unplanned assignment. So how should I make a decision when confronted with the unexpected? Perhaps there was a valuable insight in the chapter on probabilistic thinking. Envision multiple futures, and then force myself to figure out which ones are most likely and why. For a simple decision like whether I should meet my wife for lunch, the calculus is easy. In one potential future, I take an hour for lunch and come back happy and relaxed. In another, lunch goes long and we spend most of it discussing family logistics and babysitter problems. And when I get back to my desk, I'm fried and behind schedule. By thinking through potential futures, I was better prepared to influence which of those futures would actually occur. When choosing a restaurant to meet my wife, for instance, I suggested one close to my office so I could make it back to my desk quickly. When family logistics came up during lunch, I asked my wife to wait until that evening to talk calendars. By anticipating the future, I was better prepared to make wiser decisions. But bigger decisions, such as whether to take on an exciting new writing assignment, require a bit more analysis. Midway through writing this book, for instance, a production company asked if I was interested in developing a TV show. To decide if I should pursue that opportunity, which would delay my reporting but might pay off in the long run, I wrote out a few potential futures of what might happen if I worked on writing a show. Future 1. I spend a lot of time working and my show goes nowhere. Future 2. I spend a lot of time working and my show is a hit. Future 3. I spend a modest amount of time working and my show goes nowhere. Future 4. I spend a modest amount of time working and my show is a hit. I had no idea how to evaluate these potential futures. I knew there were dozens of other possibilities I should be considering but couldn't anticipate. And so I called some friends in television. Based on those conversations, I assigned each scenario a rough probability. Future 1, 45% probability. Because you can pour a lot of time into a show, but most never succeed. Future 2, 5% probability. Because even though most shows go nowhere, you never know. Future 3, 45% probability. Because I can control how much time I invest if I plan wisely. Future 4, 5% probability. Because, who knows? Based on the estimations of professionals, it seemed most possible that if I invested a lot of time, it wasn't likely to pay off. But if I invested a modest amount of time, there was a likelihood I would learn something, if nothing else. At that point, I wanted to let my Bayesian instincts guide me, and so I spent a few days letting my imagination play with various outcomes. In the end, I decided that there was another potential future I was ignoring. That even if this show never materialized, I might have a lot of fun. So I decided to commit, but I specified up front that I wanted my participation to be modest. It was a great decision. All told, my involvement in the project was small, probably the equivalent of 2 weeks. But the payoffs have exceeded my expectations. The show will premiere this fall, and I've learned a lot working on it. What's most important, however, is that I made this decision in a deliberate way. Because I had anticipated various possibilities about what might occur, and, in fact, had drawn up some stretch and SMART goals before joining the project, I was able to manage my involvement. To make better decisions, envision multiple futures. By pushing yourself to imagine various possibilities, some of which might be contradictory, you're better equipped to make wise choices. We can hone our Bayesian instincts by seeking out different experiences, perspectives, and other people's ideas. By finding information and then letting ourselves sit with it, options become clearer. The Big Idea. This appendix offers a quick overview of a few key concepts that have been meaningful in my own day-to-day life. If you can become more motivated, more focused, better at setting goals and making good decisions, then you're a long way down the path to becoming more productive. There are, of course, other ideas in this book that also help when we are managing other people, when we are trying to learn faster, when we need to innovate faster. Each of those areas of productivity have their own insights as well. To make teams more effective, manage the how not the who of teams. Psychological safety emerges when everyone feels like they can speak in roughly equal measure, and when teammates show they are sensitive to how each other feel. If you are leading a team, think about the message your choices reveal. Are you encouraging equality in speaking or rewarding the loudest people? Are you showing you are listening by repeating what people say and replying to questions and thoughts? Are you demonstrating sensitivity by reacting when someone seems upset or flustered? Are you showcasing that sensitivity so other people will follow your lead? To manage others productively, lean and agile management techniques tell us employees work smarter and better when they believe they have more decision-making authority and when they believe their colleagues are committed to their success. By pushing decision-making to whoever is closest to a problem, managers take advantage of everyone's expertise and unlock innovation. A sense of control can fuel motivation, but for that drive to produce insights and solutions, people need to know their suggestions won't be ignored and that their mistakes won't be held against them. To encourage innovation, creativity often emerges by combining old ideas in new ways, and innovation brokers are key. To become a broker yourself and encourage brokerage within your organization, be sensitive to your own experiences. Paying attention to how things make you think and feel is how we distinguish clichés from real insights. Study your own emotional reactions. Recognize that the stress that emerges amid the creative process isn't a sign everything is falling apart. Rather, creative desperation is often critical. Anxiety can be what often pushes us to see old ideas in new ways. Finally, remember that the relief accompanying a creative breakthrough, while sweet, can also blind us to alternatives. By forcing ourselves to critique what we've already done, by making ourselves look at it from different perspectives, by giving new authority to someone who didn't have it before, we retain clear eyes. To absorb data better, when we encounter new information, we should force ourselves to do something with it. Write yourself a note explaining what you just learned, or figure out a small way to test an idea, or graph a series of data points onto a piece of paper, or force yourself to explain an idea to a friend. Every choice we make in life is an experiment. The trick is getting ourselves to see the data embedded in those decisions, and then to use it somehow so we learn from it. What's most important throughout all these concepts is the foundational idea undergirding these lessons, the tissue that connects the 8 insights at the heart of this book. Productivity is about recognizing choices that other people often overlook. It's about making certain decisions in certain ways. The way we choose to see our own lives, the stories we tell ourselves, and the goals we push ourselves to spell out in detail. The culture we establish among teammates. The ways we frame our choices and manage the information in our lives. Productive people and companies force themselves to make choices most other people are content to ignore. Productivity emerges when people push themselves to think differently. When I was working on this book, I came upon a story that I loved, one of my favorite bits of reporting. The tale involved Malcolm McLean, the man who essentially created the modern shipping container. McLean died in 2001, but he left behind videotapes and numerous records, and I spent months reading about him, as well as interviewing members of his family and dozens of his former colleagues. They described a man who had relentlessly chased an idea that shipping goods inside of big metal boxes would make docks more productive, and how that insight eventually transformed manufacturing, the transportation industry, and the economies of whole continents. They explained that McLean was so productive because he was fanatically obsessed with a single idea. I devoted many, many hours to learning about MacLean. I wrote several drafts of his story, determined to fit it into this book. In the end, however, none of them worked. The lesson he offered, that a single-minded devotion to an idea can spur massive change, turned out not to be as universal and important as the other concepts I wanted to explain. MacLean's story was interesting, but not vital. What worked for him doesn't work for everyone. There are lots of examples where fanatical devotion has backfired. His insight wasn't big enough to be included among the other 8 ideas in this book. And yet the time I spent researching MacLean was worth it, because discarding that work helped me understand the mechanics of focus. My mental model of this book kept conflicting with what I was learning about MacLean. My SMART plan for the MacLean story didn't match up with my stretch goal of describing universally applicable lessons. In other words, researching MacLean helped me figure out what this book was supposed to be about. It served as a valuable reminder of how productivity actually functions. Productivity doesn't mean that every action is efficient. It doesn't mean that waste never occurs. In fact, as Disney learned, sometimes you have to foster tension to encourage creativity. Sometimes a misstep is the most important footfall along the path to success. But in the end, if you learn how to recognize certain choices that, to many, might not be obvious, then you can become smarter, faster, and better over time. Anyone can become more creative, more focused, better at framing their goals and making wise decisions. Schools can be transformed by changing how people absorb data. Teams can be taught how to learn more from mistakes, or use tension to their advantage, or make what seems like misspent hours into lessons getting them closer to their goals. Schools can be remade by empowering the people closest to a problem. The lives of senior citizens can be remade by teaching them to become subversives. We can all become more productive. Now you know how to start. This is Mike Chamberlain. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Smarter, Faster, Better: The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business by Charles Duhigg. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive Producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2016 by Charles Duhigg. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.